Hello and welcome. You're listening to Writers Aloud, a podcast brought to you by writers for the Royal Literary Fund in London. Hello and welcome to episode 351 of Writers Aloud. In this episode, we're delighted to introduce a new multi-part series, My Genre's Status. In this first instalment, we talk to writers who feel that the kind of writing they do tends to be looked down upon, and consider the factors, from funding and market forces to longevity and a perception of the skills involved, that may contribute to certain fields being literature's poor relations.
The award-winning author David Mitchell once described genre snobbery in a writer as a bizarre act of self-mutilation. The reality is, though, that for many published writers, whether we choose this or not, our work is often pigeonholed by publishers, reviewers, or others keen to identify which audiences it might suit. And where things are categorised, inevitably some things are accorded higher status than others. In this episode, My Genre's Status, we talk to writers who feel that their work tends to be regarded on the lower end of the spectrum and try to work out some of the reasons behind this and the opportunities it might pose. For children's writer Harriet Kaster, one of the major issues with the way her field is regarded has to do with the skill that people often believe lies behind her work.
It's very interesting with children's writing. I've done a lot of children's writing. Most of my books have been for children or teenagers. And there is a perception, and I know I'm not dreaming this because I've talked to other children's writers about it too, that children's writing is a lesser art form. And people will often say to children's writers, oh, yeah, you're good. Why don't you try writing a book for adults? Or when are you going to write a book for adults? As if anybody who has the ability really ought to be writing for adults. And this can be quite annoying. I think there can be a lack of awareness about what is needed or what is skillful sometimes within writing a children's book, particularly perhaps when it's nonfiction, because, of course, the sentences need to be relatively simple. The vocabulary cannot be too wide, although often it's nice to have some challenging words. But there is a definite art to writing simply, straightforwardly, clearly, and yet still entertainingly. And when it's done well, it looks easy because it flows well and, you know, does the job. And of course, it's very easy for an adult reader then to think, well, there's nothing to this. Anybody could do this. And even when I worked in publishing, there was definitely a feeling in the children's department that we were seen by the adult department in a slightly condescending way, as if we, you know, all wore dungarees and kickers and played with Lego all day.
John Mayhew, another children's writer, agrees skills are often underestimated in his writing. However, for him, children's writers have to write for not just one audience, but two.
I do think often people equate children's literature with simplicity and maybe naivety. And that often says a lot about maybe their attitude towards children as well. So they maybe think that that children are fairly simple beings with simple drives and motives, and they're actually not looking at them as people. It was funny, actually. I was lucky enough to run a long writing course at the Swanwick Summer Writing School this year, and it was entitled Writing for Children. And by the end of it, I kind of thought to myself, do you know, actually, I should just have this course entitled Writing for People, because all the same rules apply. It's a good story, well told, really. The difficulty I find, And the one thing that people don't appreciate, is that actually when you write for children, you're writing for two audiences. So you're writing for the children themselves, first of all. So it has to be an accessible plot. It has to be an accessible story that they recognise, that they're going to enjoy. It has to excite them. It has to involve them. But also you're writing for the gatekeepers. So you're writing for the librarians and the teachers and the parents, who are going to look at that book very critically and consider whether it's going to upset their children, whether it's too violent, whether it's too gory, whether it's too sad, whether it's too tragic, whether it deals with adult issues. And they're going to make that judgment first, and they're the people you have to get past first of all. So you have to write quite skillfully. You have to write in a way that engages children but also doesn't worry the gatekeepers. And that's quite a tough thing to do.
For travel writer John Gregson, the shifting trends in the way travel writing is often presented have had a marked effect on the way his field is seen.
There is certainly in the UK a much larger crossover between travel writers who write books and travel writers who write travel articles for newspapers, magazines. Writers working in other genres, novelists, poets, historians, they tend to make their appearance in the national press, primarily as book reviewers. Travel writers actually have their own slot to write their own impressions and words in that media. That means that there's much more cross-fertilisation, but it also means that a sort of debasement of the currency can occur. I think more recently its status has sunk. Part of it is the mass media's much more consumerist approach to travel. The best 10 beaches, cottages, soundbite suggestions offered before you can follow them up on Google. And so basically there are less joined up words being used out there. And so there is now a greater divergence, if you like, between travel writing for newspapers and magazines and the travel writer who does books. There's also the invasion of the celebs. Travel articles that are written by actors from EastEnders or famous TV chefs, where it's the name rather than any intrinsic skills which are the draw.
But while famous names play a role in selling certain kinds of work, other writers often don't expect their name to be recognised at all. Education writer Becca Heddle knows this feeling well.
I think it's largely because while almost everybody reads or has read these sorts of books at some point in their lives, they are a stepping stone rather than an end in themselves. You read science textbooks to learn science. You read reading scheme books in order to learn to read better. And they don't become treasured things. They're only there in school. Your interest in them is inherently ephemeral. And while some schemes might become household names, Ant and Bee, Janet and John, Oxford Reading Tree's Biff, Chip and Kipper, quite often it's not necessarily in a really positive way as far as the members of the household are concerned. They're like, oh God, we were reading those books for years, or hasn't educational writing moved on from those days? And the authors are very much secondary to the schemes. I don't think anybody is aware of any educational author as a household name. One of the things which suggests this low status is the occasional claim of reading schemes to be bringing out new books written by real authors, by which they mean the household names whose output is fantastic. But it does rather make those who write exclusively for these schemes and are not household names feel somewhat undervalued, as if we really don't have very much to offer. Is that because it's not seen as creative in the same way that people whose names are almost brands? Is it because of the hoop jumping that we have to do to fit into the curriculum, the level of writing? That all makes it quite technical, and so perhaps it falls into some sort of a notional gap between art and craft is never admired as much as art.
There are certain kinds of writers who are paid to be invisible. For ghostwriter Mark McCrum, this is not always a bad thing.
I can think of ghost-written books that have been beautifully written, but the poor old ghost doesn't take any of the credit, even when they die. In fact, one of the reasons I've given up on ghosting is that a friend of mine, a ghost, died not so long ago, and her obituary had no mention of her best bit of work. That book and the credit for it belongs entirely to her client, as you can see from the credit below her name on her email. There's no point complaining about it if you're a ghost. That's just how it is. As my agent once said, the clue's in the name, Mark. Ghosts are invisible. On the other hand, I know some happy ghosts. There is something intriguing and rewarding about being allowed to get very close to remarkable people, to being allowed to ask them questions you wouldn't even ask a member of your family. And generally you get paid. Sometimes you get paid well. That can make up for a lot, especially when you see your snooty fellow writers in more elevated genres struggling to pay the bills. When I die, I think I'm going to endow a prize for ghosts. I think it's important in this lowly, possibly not even a genre too, that good work gets recognised. There's plenty of terrible ghostwriting. The problem is that nobody knows who's writing it. There's a literary agent who gives a party for ghosts every year on Halloween. It's good fun, as parties with the lowest of the low often are. Anyway, you don't know who you're talking to. Might be a pop star, a footballer, an equestrian, a distinguished politician. And here's a secret. Some of the ghosts are quite attractive. Who would have guessed that? And as the evening wears on, the stories come out. They did what? That is just too much. Ghosts can get drunk too, you see. But they're always discreet. To be a good ghost, you have to keep secrets. I would love to tell you what that pop star did with that Alsatian, but I'm afraid I can't. Her secret is safe with me. I may be scum, but I have my pride.
Seeing your work published without your name on the cover may be challenging, but for some writers, having a published text at all is a dream. For playwright Roxana Ahmed, the fact that many theatre productions don't yield published texts is part of the reason that her genre has traditionally been overlooked.
Although the British Library always kept a record of every play that was produced, and probably still does, I think the justification for literature has always been the fact that that piece of work will have longevity. And I'm not sure longevity is something that should give something a huge status. I feel screenplays also have, as a genre, a bit of prejudice against them, because films are seen as a non-serious medium. And yet they can be quite transforming in terms of people's attitude to things. I think one of the greatest pieces of work is 12 Years a Slave, which you could not see without flinching, but which said something so profound about a historical experience that I'm sure it had a huge effect on people's minds. So it's interesting that theatre is not given the status that it deserves. I feel that this will change. It's interesting that that status of literature is accorded to Shakespeare, but Shakespeare alone. Whereas my own relationship with Shakespeare has been a rather difficult one. I find some of the plays sexist, I find some of the plays racist, and I find some of the assumptions very uncomfortable. But Shakespeare's enjoyed that status not because of being theatre, but because of being a text. And all those playwrights who have the good luck to survive their own generation and are published as texts acquire that status.
Radio dramatist Annie Caulfield agrees that transience can play a big part in the respect accorded to a field. For her, it's one of the reasons that radio dramatists are rarely household names.
You have a wonderful artistic freedom in radio drama, but nobody knows you're doing it, really. It has a bigger audience than fringe theatre, but the peak figure would be about 1 million. So actually there are more people listening to radio drama than you would think, but it has no profile at all. There's a man, Mike Walker, who's written innumerable radio plays, who is the Shakespeare of radio, and nobody's ever heard of him. Nobody's ever heard of him. Because you can have a play on at the Royal Court upstairs and gain more profile, bigger reviews, launch your career that way. But I don't think anybody has ever launched their career in radio. And I think it's a shame, because this is where there's a play every day, at least. Series, serials, abridgments, adaptations. It's a great place for writers to be working, and so unsung. I can't think the last time I saw a feature about this unique dramatic form that we have in Britain. I don't think they have it anywhere else in the world. I don't know if they have it in Australia. Maybe. I think there are publicly funded radio stations in America that occasionally do drama. So that's slightly scary, because if the BBC wasn't publicly funded, they couldn't afford to do radio drama. And that would be the end. That would be the very end of this form. Unless people started to sort of do them in their own living rooms and put them on the internet, there'd be no radio drama. And it's a very particular form, and I think somebody should do a feature about it, just occasionally in a Sunday magazine. It should get a little bit more publicity. They sometimes trail things on television, but I know I've made quite an effort to always have a very starry cast, so we might occasionally get a panel in the Radio Times, but you're never going to get the cover of the Radio Times. I think it's something the BBC should be a little bit prouder of, because it's where writers learn, actors learn. A lot of directors and producers learn in radio. There's an incredible technical level of skill in radio drama.
Another issue, according to Caulfield, is the sort of platform given to radio drama. In particular, the timing of the slots in which it is often commissioned.
The main slot for an afternoon play is after The Archers, or the weekend, it comes after Gardener's Question Time, which kind of tells you what kind of audience they're going to get. It's going to be Middle England. And, you know, they might occasionally enjoy a little frisson of shock at the content of the play. But the play is basically going to suit the kind of people who have a nice garden and listen to The Archers. There was a really exciting time. Well, Channel 4 thought they were going to go into radio drama production. And they even made a really good trailer, which reminded you of what Channel 4 had done for British television in making it more edgy, completely turned it upside down from the rather, you know, end of the pier stuff that was going on ITV and the rather proper stuff that was done on the BBC. Then Channel 4 came in and everything erupted. And it may be with cable and so on that this can happen, but they then realised actually just how expensive radio drama is to do on a commercial basis. But it would be nice if there was another outlet apart from the BBC, partly because as a writer, you could say, oh, the BBC don't want it. Maybe I can do it on Channel 4 because it is a bit rude. But it's the BBC where you can't be too rude, where there's a sort of art house slot sort of late at night on Radio 3, but four people listen to it.
Some genres, by their very nature, are aimed at small audiences. Anne Coben, who, among other things, writes for rural touring theatre, knows very well that her plays will never reach large numbers of people. And this is part of their charm.
I remember a little boy who became so involved in the magic of a production of my Christmas play, Alex and the Warrior, that he stood up in the middle of a scene and told the warrior what to do to save the day. And because he was sitting on a mat at the feet of the actors, he became part of the show. His magical theatrical experience cost his family £5 and a walk down the street from their home to their village hall. So it's so important, this area of theatre. I have a long-standing working relationship with Northumberland Theatre Company, who have toured my play Get Up and Tie Your Fingers about an East Coast fishing community. It's built around the Eyemouth disaster of 1881, and it's about three women who live in that community. And I remember when we took the play to Fraserburgh, after the disaster, Molly, whose father has drowned, sings a children's hymn about the fishing, and then the other two women join in. And in a spine-tingling moment, all the men in the hall stood up and joined in and sang the bass line. And it still makes the hairs on the back of my neck stand up. It's a difficult life, rural touring. When Northumberland Theatre Company take a show on the road, they pack their whole lives into a van, they travel hundreds of miles through all kinds of weather. Every day starts and ends with a journey. Every show is a one-night stand, and that involves a full get-in and a get-out, but they carry on. And this kind of touring is undervalued and under-reviewed, and unfortunately now underfunded, because in 2011, Arts Council England withdrew all funding from over half of the rural touring theatre companies it supported, and one of those companies was NTC. They're still out there on the road, only now it's not only the weather they're battling, the fight is on to find alternative funding.
But while funding may be important, poet John Sadiq warns against pursuing it at all costs.
Because the only way to make a living or survive as a poet is to pursue funding, usually, or the only way that a literary magazine can exist is because of funding or because of, you know, having a certain patron or something like that, then the chasing of the funding almost becomes kind of sort of central to the thing. So less risk is taken, I suppose, and art goes out the window. Then you have to fit the buzzwords of the organisation that you're applying to. You have to fit in with what that society, in inverted commas, kind of is asking of you. And it's not asking for art. It's asking for things that have quantitative aspects rather than qualitative aspects, such as appealing to a young audience, audience development, that there's a digital component. None of those things are writing. None of those things are the art. None of those things are sitting, looking at a tree or a plant or the sea until you feel like you've become the tree, the plant or the sea, and then something in you renders that into the beauty of our language. And so we get lost. We're lost between wanting to be poets and trying to make a living at it. And I don't know what the answer is. You know, I don't. And as I said, I'm also guilty of this. But it's the reason why we're in a mess. If we're going to be crazy enough to be writers and poets, we should aim as high as possible to kind of create the greatest art that we can. Anything that stops us doing that because we want to present in a certain way actually is stealing from the art. It's that commitment to the art itself that's missing. If that was there, then the thing would sort itself out.
The key, says Sadiq, is to remain true to ourselves and our work, rather than getting distracted by performing what we imagine the genre may require.
The problem with being a poet, or the wanting to be seen to be a poet, rather, is that all our time is then spent on working our image. We can create a lovely website, we can tweet all day long, you know, we can have our Facebook page, but we're not working on our craft. And we may not even know what our craft is, but we know that we want to be seen as something. So it's actually a kind of an egoic framework. It's actually a created image. Rather than being a poet, we want to be seen to be a poet. But we think it's impossible. We think it's too hard. Or we think, well, we're not prepared to find out what it means, which means reading a lot of books, years of books, lifetimes of books, and kind of finding the best writing that there is and trying to understand the elements that make that the best writing. And then how does our little art do something in itself? You know, it's too big. It's much easier to buy a website, to get some nice shots, to hit the tropic topics, you know, and say the things that people expect us to say because they fit in with society or whatever, because we want to be seen to be something. And that's my challenge to anybody listening to this, to kind of, you know, just get on with the art.
A challenge that writers everywhere, regardless of genre, may do well to take up. That was my genre's status. The featured writers were Harriet Caster, John Mayhew, John Gregson, Annie Caulfield, Ruxana Ahmed, Anne Coburn, John Sadiq, Becca Heddle, and Mark McCrum. You can find out more about the writers featured in this episode on the RLF website.
And that concludes episode 351, which was recorded by the Writers Aloud team and produced by Anne Morgan. Coming up in episode 352, Emma Darwin speaks with Anne Morgan about learning by doing, research versus storytelling, and writing what you come to know. We hope you'll join us. You've been listening to Writers Aloud, a podcast brought to you by writers for the Royal Literary Fund in London. To subscribe to podcasts and to find out more about the work of the RLF, please visit our website at www.rlf.org.uk. Thanks for listening.